Major Seppings, Radio 7.
Yes, only we kept these agents and eventually get them back to base security. Another thing that I did was to drop survival kit for RAF crews that were flying from India to bombing areas in Burma and Malaya. And there were a whole lot of islands along this coast, this western coast of Burma. And I had, these survival kits were made up of teak boxes lined inside with aluminium. And I was told that they had a fixed transmitter, medicines, food, water, pistols, 30-30 carbine, everything to assist these people if they had to ditch in the sea to be able to get to this island, knowing that they were able to get these supplies and exist and transmit back, and they would then get picked up. I was told to bury these things. Now, the Burmese, and particularly these sea gypsies that lived along the coast there, they were terrified of anything that had to do with burials and spirits and what have you. So I used to bury them, bury the stuff, put a mound and put a cross, and I know we had to put, we had these things, little strips, pilot officer prune. I don't know why it said P.O. prune. So I think all in all, I spent June, July, August, September, making my own arrangements, which was very good. I must say Colonel Heath was very, very tolerant. He knew I was doing something rather than sit in headquarters there. I used to disappear from time to time. My wife didn't know what I was up to, and then come back. Each little operation, say, took about 10 to 14 days. It was very pleasant being out in the ocean there and sitting on a motor launch. I know that we had to take chances because there was this fighter strip at a place called Dom Bike, which the RAF were very interested in. And I did go land against all orders and went with this group, and we had a look at this Dom Bike airstrip, and of course I reported back there were at least three squadrons of Japanese O fighters there. They were using it as a base. They were then, at that time, they were then attacking installations and the dockyards in Chittagong. They were acting as escorts for bombers that came over, and there was sort of cursory bombing of Chittagong and Calcutta at the time, end of 1942, early 1943, and there were sort of incursions every now and again. But strange enough, they were not as active as we thought they would be. The RAF, of course, blasted quite a few of these fighters off the ground there. But anyway, I went in and I was able to signal back saying I have first-hand knowledge. The only snag we had with local agents was that they were prone to exaggerate things. So it was far better for one of us to go along and then get as precise information as we possibly could. Everything that they sent in, we had to evaluate. If they were told there were a large number of Japanese troops, I think it was difficult for them to estimate, but they automatically became 3,000 Jap troops, and in fact it wasn't that at all. Sometimes they underestimated, sometimes they overestimated. In fact, when the Battle of the Box in Mungdor, the famous seven-day box, our agents reported that there were a battalion of Japanese troops. In fact, it turned out to be a brigade of Japanese Imperial troops who were first-class fighters. So there was an underestimation instead of an overestimation.
When you did this kind of recce work on the West Burma coast, it sounds as though the Japanese didn't intercept you at all.
No, that was very, very... We were very lucky there. We were always aware that we could be attacked. But strange enough, every operation I went on, we came back unscathed, and yet we were miles away from synagogue. If you imagine the west coast of Burma and right down to the Bassi and Irrawaddy Delta, that's a good 300 miles by sea. And right out in the open sea, an open motor launch on its own. All right, we had anti-aircraft, we had an Oerlikon aboard, and we had twin Vickers, but that was hardly anything against Japanese fighters intercepting us. And why they didn't attack British naval movements from this fighter strip in Dombai, I still wonder. I think what the Japs had got to the stage then, that if they went and attacked, they found that the retaliation was so intense that I think they thought to themselves, well, let's keep the peace sort of business. We've taken Burma, and let's be quite content. There's no way we can. They had no idea then that they were going to attack India. This followed later on in 1944. But that the activity in that area. You see, the Japanese Imperial Brigade now, they attacked Mangdaw, and our chaps were in the 7-div box. Now, why they didn't go any further and go into East Bengal, I don't know.
But when you went on these raids, who did you usually go with in the boat?
Royal Navy. You mean my men?
Well, who exactly was in the boat on
well,
a typical
was
occasion?
Well, it the crew of the motor launch. Lieutenant, normally, or the sub-lieutenant, and about six crew. They were like MTBs. They were known as Fairmile launches. At a top speed of about 2,100 knots. It was very pleasant for me. It was like a cruise in the sea there. No question of worrying about whether a fighter was going to come over. I think we were all so young. I got the skipper to agree that if we did get attacked, I would get onto the Oerlikon and start firing at anything. And that was part of the fun of the thing. I don't know.
And who was in your SOE party in the boat?
I had a wireless operator with me, and I had agents that I was dropping off, or agents that I picked up. But basically, I had a base. I set up a base in a small group of island called St. Martin's. Now, that was well away from the mainland. They had fresh water there. There was a little volcano with fresh water. And there was quite a lot of good fishing around there. So I set a base up there. I had another base on an island called Seppings Island. And I researched that island, and it was my granduncle, who was an admiral in the Royal Navy, and he was a surveyor admiral, who apparently in the 1910 surveyed the coast of Burma. He then had a base in Chiduba Island, which is south of Ramri Island. And when I went there as DSP, Chief of Police, to Ramri Island, I went to Chiduba, and I found records in the Chiduba Municipal Office there of my grandfather's having arrived there, dates of burials. You see, the place was infested with malaria. A lot of the crew died. I believe also I met people who looked very European, and they were the progeny of the sailors who were there. So that was Seppings Island. It was just a rugged island with a small, a little beach, and I kept stores there. And I told RAF crews that if they went, close by, to make for that. We had these islands, the RAF had marked them off, where St. Martin's was marked off, that was on the map, Seppings Island as well. All these other islands were given numbers. I know there were prefixed with A. A, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. A meaning Arakan. And then as you got towards the Irrawaddy Delta, those islands were marked B. I think I laid supplies and survival kits to about 10 different islands. And this took, wasn't done in a fortnight. This took me about 2-3 months. I had to go back to headquarters. All the survival kits, of course, were at Chittagong. But I went back, I had a bit of a break, and then I went out on my own, picked my time, depending on weather. We were height of the monsoons then, and we were sort of restricted slightly. But I don't think it bothered me at all, but that was what I did from about June to October. Then in October, plans, I was accredited to OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, in Calcutta. And I had the pleasure of meeting an actor, Melvin Douglas, who was the head of the OSS. They were a similar organization to SOE. Had just almost arrived in the Far East. They were extending there. They were well known in Western Europe, but they were sort of rather new to the Far East. And the first sea operation, I was brought in to help these people, and of course we then went down to Ceylon. Now I took a couple of agents down as well, because we were had an operation on Timor Island, Operation Breach, and we set out, I think it was about the 18th of December 1943.
Was this a recce operation?
No. It was landing agents and migrating ashore and what have you. As far as we were concerned, I was to set up a base in a place on an island south of Bentinck Island in the Mergui Archipelago, and also a base on Tavoy Island. But we excluded Tavoy Island because we realized that it was probably inhabited. There was no point in going there. It wasn't a very large one. So the Americans were going into Tavoy itself. So we went into camp in Trincomalee on the east side of Ceylon, where there were quite a few organizations setting off to Sumatra, the Dutch East Indies. Some by Catalina, some by submarine. And as I say, we set off, I think it was about the 16th of December, because I know we spent Christmas Day afloat. And in a submarine, T-class submarine called Trespasser. The head of the OSS organization was then Lieutenant Ken Pier, P-I-E-R. He was an interesting chap. He was attached to the photographic unit at Hollywood. And he knew people like James Stewart and all these others. He had an ensign with it, and there's some Burmese Tavoy. They're known as Tavoyans. If they come from Tavoy, they're known as Tavoy. That's about four Tavoyan agents. Christmas Eve, we came off Tavoy Island, and Pier, there was a lot of fishing vessels around when we surfaced, and Pier decided to capture a couple of these fishing vessels because he had so much kit. I helped him to sort out his kit in Trincomalee. They were expecting to go in there with petrol-driven generators and what have you, and I said, well, once your petrol runs out, where are you going to get the petrol from? We are wireless sets. We had what we call cycle generators. They were hard work, but at least you got enough power into our system so that you could transmit. We had some practice runs with these rubber boats that we had. They were most unwieldy. We were using the small type black rubber boat and the big yellow type Australian rubber boat. Well, the small ones couldn't carry much weight. The big ones, was a devil of a job to try and row the thing because you had an oar each side. And unless you coordinated very, very well and you had very still water, all that you did was you went around in circles. However, he decided then that the best thing to do was to capture a couple of fishing vessels, get his equipment aboard. He wasn't landing at all. We sent these chaps off. Of course, we were landed with four fishermen, two apiece from each. We had to put them on the submarine. The commander, Dickie Flavelle, said, "What do we do with these people?" And I said, "Well, I suppose when we land, eventually," I decided to land much further south, because I was quite convinced that these chaps would be captured, because the other fishing vessels would have shot off, gone ashore, and reported that two of their fishing vessels were captured. As it turned out, we got news over the radio that the Japanese had captured these five men from OSS, and they were executed on Christmas Day. And I say, I moved very far south, and I got onto this island south of Benting Island, well away from my area of operations, but my idea was to work myself up and get as close as possible to Tavoy, which I did, actually, and I dropped two agents into Tavoy. I had arranged for the submarine to pick me up after 4 days, and I was aboard the submarine. These chaps had been dropped in. Then we had a signal arranged between us, because they didn't have a wireless set, which was ridiculous. That was one of the comments I made when we came back, to say, if you put agents as far south as that, you've got to give them wireless sets. But they were sent in for a week to find out various things. And the idea was that when they did finish the operation, they had a small phone book which they got ashore. I taught them how to use a torch with SOS. And on the appointed seventh night, the submarine got up very close to where they were going to rendezvous on the shoreline. I think we were probably about half a mile out. It was a very heavy sea. We could see a torch being used from the mainland through the binoculars, but because of the swell, it seemed that they were sending long messages rather than dot, 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 dot. And I said, no, I think it's... He said, "You're sure that they haven't been sort of caught and there's somebody signaling?" The signaler was picking up all sorts of things, but it was all garbled. So I said, "Well, the best thing is that I can get into a full board and go ashore." The CO, Dickie Flavelle, said, "Oh, well, that's a bit dicey." So one of his officers, a chap called Hamilton, he got into another full board, and we hitched up together so we wouldn't get lost. The sea was utterly, totally black, and we headed towards the shore. When we got to within a reasonable distance from the shore where we could see what was happening, certainly whoever was using that torch was more or less sending full messages, because then the torch wasn't sort of obliterated by the swell. And we couldn't hear each other. Hamilton and I, of course, were roar of the waves and what have you, but I looked there and it seemed much more than SOS. And as we got a bit closer, the next thing the Japanese opened up was machine guns. Of course, we heard this plop, plop, plop around us, and we realized we were being fired on. So we about turned and got back to the submarine, and we never picked those chaps up. It was a man called Cho Thu, who was Karen, who lived in that area. And I think I told him, I said, "Look, if we can't pick you up, just disappear, go and join your relations and take the other chap with you." And we never heard from him again. So that was the last operation I was involved in. That's mentioned in a book by Ian Trenodden called Operation The Most Secret.
And it was Operation Breach.
Breach. Breach. We just get a brief mention. I've always planned to go to the public records office at Kew, because I know that I went to Gosport in 1964 for a submarine reunion. where I met some of the officers that I'd met in Trincomalee. I didn't meet Dicky Prevel. I don't know where he'd gone to. I think he was South African. And I was told that all the logs had been moved to the submarine depot at near Lowestoft somewhere. That would have given me much more information on the log. In fact, I helped to keep the log on the submarine, because I had nothing to do there. And then when I wanted to get some information, I was told that all the records were at the public records office at Kew. I've never had the chance to get to Kew. We've been up there, but I've often taken my wife because she's wanted to see the garden. But I promised myself, I've been in touch with the people at Kew. They said, well, you have to come along. We'll give you the information. You do your own research.
But that Tavoy operation was purely OSS?
No, ISLD as well. But on that particular occasion, I was accredited to Force 136, A Group. We were interchangeable.
What was A Group?
A was Burma, and I think B was Siam and Dutch East Indies, that way. But that was an A Group 136 operation. I was the first, I believe I was the first officer accredited to the Americans. And I advised them on the thing, but of course theirs was a disaster. Their chaps got captured. And I think that Ken Pierre was very, very distressed because the Japanese actually gave the names of these people on Christmas Day. I remember Christmas night. They were caught on Christmas Day and they gave the names out. And they said they would all be shot as spies. I don't think OSS might have conducted further operations from Salon Agatha, because that was my last meeting with them. And when I got back to Calcutta, of course, I was in contact with OSS there. They were carrying out operations on the Burma-India border then, up north with Merrill's Marauders and all those sort of people.
Why was this your last operation with SOE?
Well, we were into 44 then, 1944. I was brought back to headquarters, and I was conducting all sorts of things, one of which was rather amusing. One of our agents had been parachuted in. I didn't know him at all, but the Japanese had got hold of this chap, and it made out that he was still operating for us. And every month I used to drop a pannier to this chap as though we still believed that he was operating. I don't know what, it was a deception then. I think you see, ISLD had different groups. They had E group, D group, deception group. I think we were involved with the Ministry of Economic Warfare in some sort of way. So I spent all my time at headquarters with these small operations. I was also flying with agents as a conducting officer and see them dropped in their various areas, reporting back that all chutes had opened and what have you. Generally, we were known as conducting officers then. Several of us did this.
Which airfield did you operate from?
From Dum Dum, Calcutta, yeah. But we went to northern Burma. I went to right eastern Burma, right down to Maulmain. I also looked after agents who were in Calcutta. I gave them some sort of training. There were several of us who trained these people. We were teaching them to identify Japanese army formations with Japanese signs. I learnt a little bit about Japanese characters, but mainly to see that they were all right, that they were entertained, and then when they were ready to be dropped, I arranged for them to be taken down to Dum Dum. Later on, we moved to a place called Jesson, from where we flew. 357 Squadron had a mixed bunch. They had Liberators, they had DC-3s, Hudsons, and depending on how far these people were being sent in, we took off on these aircraft, and I went with them. We had a little base at Jessore as well, an RSLD bungalow where we, the men stayed prior to being taken over, you see, and then dropped. So I was a conducting officer and generally looking after all our agents.
What were the main problems you had in doing that job?
Not much, no. By that time, I think we had more or less established a proper pattern. Our agents were reporting back on WT. Some were caught. Some were killed on landing. I know I had a very amusing pair. I had two Burmese women. Now, I had nothing to do with their training except to look after them. These two women were supposed to be prostitutes that they'd found from somewhere. We had a Burmese refugee camp in northern Assam, and I had to look after them. I had to take them up to Rawalpindi to do their parachute training. It was quite amusing. The RAF were quite tickled with these people because they insisted on jumping with their sarongs on. And of course, the sarongs were acting like parachutes. And I said, look, to these women, any objection to getting into a pair of slacks or jodhpurs? And they seemed to go for riding breeches. So I got them fitted up with jodhpurs, and they did their parachute training there. And I had all their kit in my flat a couple of days before we dropped them. We dropped them near Mandalay. And my wife wondered who the devil these people were. And it was only then that she realized what I was up to with parachutes downstairs, all this kit. And these two women, she was a bit suspicious of these two women. I said, no, don't worry about that at all. They absolutely took a shine to me. They relied entirely on me because I was looking after them. And it was 1944, I think it was reasonable weather. It must have been about September, about October. I went out on Dakota with these two, and we dropped them over Mandalay, and I thought, we'll see the last of them. Strangely enough, one woman, headquarters lost contact with her completely. The other one managed to ingratiate herself with a Japanese colonel, was actually sending information back. But I had nothing to do with collating the information. All that I was interested in was, had they landed? Had we made contact? They said they'd lost one, and I dropped over Sagai. But the other one who I dropped at Mandalay apparently carried on till we started to move into Burma in 45, sending information back. Because they were trained to use WT sets as well.
What did you think of the general caliber of the agents you were conducting?
They were good. They were good. I think one of the things I had to impress on them, the danger of going in, and that, you know, that if they had wives and families and what have you, that we would look after them. But those that really joined us were dedicated people who wanted to see the Japanese out of Burma. They were motivated by that, I think, because they were keen. They were keen to do the parachute training. I mean, the ground training before we was actually taken up in the end and dropped on our training exercise, very hard work. We were jumping on these coir mats, and we didn't have a tower there in Chakrala and Rawalpindi, not like the parachute training schools here.